Good morning, everybody. Maybe in the beginning we shut the door. If it gets too warm, maybe we have to open it again. So first question, as each week, do you have questions? Did you come across things you didn't understand when you looked at the slides again? Did you do some homework which you want to discuss? So, first, any questions towards the slides? I personally would expect some, because what we did last week, the proof of the sender anonymity scheme, the fail-stop key generation variation within the DC network, and discussing about traps, it's all slightly complicated, so it's not the very easiest part of the lecture. So I would expect some questions.
I didn't understand how it works to find out who attacks or who, if somebody sends some garbage messages, how we can find out who sent this.
Okay, then this is, for example, one question I did expect, because it's a kind of complicated protocol, and maybe we have to go through it once again. And maybe you interrupt me if I'm doing it too fast or if I don't explain it thoroughly enough. So I think this was the slide we had. First, let's get clear what the problem is. It's pretty clear. We have a kind of channel which is additive. So if one station sends garbage, the sum is garbage, which is some kind of dual property to the sender anonymity. So if you have a system with sender anonymity, usually an anonymous sender can disturb others. And because by definition the sender is anonymous, it's not trivial to do something against that. Nevertheless, we would agree that in extreme circumstances, we would like to do something against it. One is availability. If disturbing the network means no useful use of the network anymore, then we have to do something against it. Or if it's not about disturbing the network, but misusing it, for example, you send a threatening message, I'm going to kill everybody who is interested in anonymity, then probably the anonymity geeks would like to know, oh, is this a joke or is this to be taken seriously? And if it's to be taken seriously, what can we do against it? So they would like to know who was the sender. Okay, so problem seems to be clear, and the tension between anonymity on the one hand, which shall be provided by the network, and traceability, that is, finding out in extreme situation who did what. So this tension is clear as well, okay? So now it gets specific, because now we have to take into account what kind of anonymous network we are using, because the details of tracing people, laying traps, etc., 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 depends on the network. Okay. Maybe I go even a little bit back further. The problem we now have, this kind of tension, is under which circumstances do we allow that the message is traced. On the one hand, we would say it should be possible. On the other hand, having kind of anonymous network means you have some guarantee, if you well behave, that your message isn't traced. And again, this is a kind of tension. I spoke about this tension using the slide with the reservation blobs and told you, okay, a reservation can mean two things. A reservation can be a reservation for sending a useful message, for sending a message containing maybe personal information. Such a message we would like not to trace. With the exception, maybe if it's a threatening message, you would like to trace it just because of its personal content. But a personal message, usually, you wouldn't like to trace because the availability of the network is not as good as you would like it to be. So different kinds of reservations might partition the bandwidth of our network in a part which is used for sending private information. This part you should never trace for availability reasons, maybe for reasons of the content transmitted, but not for availability reasons. And a part which is traps, mainly just sent to get an attacker to fall into the trap, which means disturbing, trying to jam that message which corresponds to a reservation, which is a trap. Now it's pretty clear, if you make a distinction between traps and non-traps, someone has to be able to decide which is a trap and which is a non-trap. Who is going to decide that? Pretty clear. This should be the person who did the reservation. Because if this person relies on that's a non-trap, then sending personal information, then he never ever would like it to be opened or handled as if it would be a trap. So one way to implement that is using for those reservations, blobs, those are commitment schemes which commit either to 0 or 1. And one of the two you define as being a trap, and the other you define as being a non-trap. And then a blob has a property that it can only be opened in one way. So the blob commits to trap or non-trap. And the blob can be opened by the party forming the blob. So the person laying a trap can decide to open the blob, demonstrating this is a trap, and asking, please trace. And if the person makes sure that the blob has the value non-trap, then he may be certain that nobody can open it, and in particular, nobody can open it as denoting this is a trap. So this was a slide making sure that in the distributed system, all honest stations agree on whether to trace or not to trace. And now we come to your question in the particular sense, if we decided to trace, how to do it. But before starting how to do it, it should be clear under what circumstances has it to be done. And what is particularly important here is, given the information, given the protocol, given the agreement to all the procedures, if I can open a blob as a trap, and if I insist that because this is a trap and I want it to be traced, then we have a rule, everybody has to cooperate tracing the corresponding message, the message which corresponds to this blob. And the rule is everybody has to cooperate. Which means if someone says, I don't, or I don't want to, or I can't, then this party is violating the protocol. So the starting point is we need a procedure which makes it absolutely clear to each honest station when to trace and when not. Because we want to be sure all honest stations agree, and a station which doesn't agree is a kind of attacker. Of course, so the procedure starts, or we say we want to trace, and now some procedure starts, what to do, and whenever a station doesn't cooperate in tracing, this station is considered as a kind of attacker. So next question is, what do we do with attackers? Of course, this depends. Why? Because even if you don't attack intentionally, maybe from time to time you make errors. I think this is pretty human. And I would even argue that computers in this respect are pretty human, because from time to time they make errors. Often they make different kinds of errors than humans, but they do. So, of course, we could discuss, hey, if we can detect that some computer misbehaved once, is this a good reason to say we are going to exclude you forever? I would say, think twice before you do so, because it's commonplace that sooner or later a computer will malfunction. Maybe he's working fine for many years, but sometimes it will fail. Human beings, maybe you have a really honest person. He doesn't do errors, he doesn't do attacks for many, many years, but anybody will sometimes. So is it a very clever idea to exclude that person on the first occasion when she or he errs and this can be demonstrated? So, okay. So I assume, and I would assume, that we are only going to punish persons or computers if they err, if they are in error or even attacking too often. This kind of threshold I'm now going to ignore. I'm now going to pretend whenever someone errs, he has to be punished. But this is nothing than a short notation, a short wording for if someone exceeds some kind of threshold, he or she has to be punished. Or if a computer is malfunctioning too often, let's get rid of that computer. Okay, from now on, I will say, if there is an error, we have to do something. Meaning, if some threshold is exceeded, we have to do something. Okay? So, what to do if we find a computer or a user in error? If it's pretty clear, it's this computer, it's this user, so what do you do? What can you do on the internet? It's really hard to send a police officer to that person because usually you have no clue under which jurisdiction this person lives and works. Often you don't know where it lives and works. In some sense, often you don't know whether there is a human being at all. You know, on the internet, nobody knows you are a dog. And putting a dog into prison is not really, let's say, commonplace. So what do you do in a distributed system? Probably you say, hey, if you have kind of identity, whatever identity might mean, it might be an IP address, this can be forged, surely. It can be a kind of public test key of a digital signature system. Whatever you have as an identity, you would say, all we can do is exclude that entity, which may not give us a good feeling that what happens is justice, because if this person really caused some damage, just excluding it may, from your feeling of justice, not be enough. But in some situations, you cannot do more. And often I would say, hey, if we form some kind of team for anonymous communication, then excluding a person who does not follow that goal is the best we can do. And in some sense, I even would say, it's justified, it's okay. So the first rule is, if you can make clear that some human being or some computer did misbehave, we are going to exclude it. Which in the DC network might mean all keys with that person are deleted. And the local output of that person isn't added anymore. So this person may send on the internet whatever he likes, but the honest participants are going to ignore it. So what I'm not talking about is now distributed denial of service attacks on the internet. Of course, a person being angry about something could send enormous amounts of traffic, but this is something I'm going to ignore because this has nothing to do with the DC network. Depending on the network infrastructure, it still may be a problem, but it's not the problem I'm discussing now. Okay. So, what else could happen? We are not finding anybody where we can prove that entity misbehaved. How we check that, I'm coming to in a minute. But we find two or even more entities being in some kind of disagreement. Maybe disagreement can be about whether they exchanged the key or not, or what the value of the key exchanged is. Whether they got the broadcast of the last round. Maybe they using the broadcast of last round or of the last rounds, plural, for generating the key of the current round. So it can easily happen in a distributed system that stations or users disagree. What do you do now? If you have disagreement, and if you take seriously this disagreement, what do you learn? You learn that those two entities will not trust each other anymore. So what do? You say, can we simplify our system on the assumption that those entities where we have disagreement don't trust each other? Because first, if they disagree that they don't trust each other, I would argue this is just an effect of life. And secondly, if we can use that to simplify the system, sounds good. So what does simplify mean? In the DC network, it means if those entities share a key to provide sender anonymity, or in the fail stop scheme to provide recipient anonymity, then let's delete the key. Because if they don't trust each other, if one considers the other as attacker, why should they share a key? So summing up until here, what do we have? If you are going to investigate, and someone can be identified as breaking some rule, we are going to exclude it. Maybe that person does not cooperate in the investigation. Maybe that person makes statements which are self-contradictory. Or, if you cannot identify someone who misbehaved, but you see that some entities have disagreements, so you know that at least one of them somehow misbehaves, then you say, okay, at least one of them is working against the commonly agreed rules. So in this sense, some of them is an attacker. So they don't trust each other. So let's use that for simplification. And in the DC network, this means deleting keys. Now I'm getting slightly more specific. If someone misbehaves, what options does he have to conceal that he misbehaved? This, of course, depends on what about that person is known. So maybe I should now start with the slide here. Assume you misbehaved about which properties can you hope to successfully lie? Because if you just admit I misbehaved, it's pretty clear you are excluded. So you are looking for a way of arguing that what you did was okay, but maybe what others did wasn't okay. And of course, if you are lying, and you are an attacker, I assume you're doing it in a clever way. So, about which facts is it impossible to lie? The output of the station. We assume that all outputs of all stations are known. In the proof of sender anonymity, we did assume that. Why? Because it was nice. It was a very, very safe assumption. We said, hey, we give the attacker a lot of information. We give all outputs of all stations to the attacker. So we are on the safe side. So this was a reason to do the proof like this. On the other hand, if you now want to trace who did what, and we know we did the proof that way, we could say, hey, now we want to make sure everybody knows everybody's output. How could we do that? For example, we could agree that each station is digitally signing each output. So signing output value, time, or round number. Okay. So we can well make sure that the output of the station cannot be changed or cannot be forged successfully after the fact. That is, we can make sure in a distributed system everybody knows all the outputs. If you make that sure, then of course lying about the output one did probably is not a successful strategy. Why? Because all honest stations within the system will say, hey, this person is lying. And by the way, this is a digital signature that this has been the value of this round. So it's obvious. This person, this station is lying. Let's exclude it. Okay? So this fact we can establish quite well. If we do a DC plus network, that is, if we want to use the broadcast value in the key generation, then we also have to check to make sure that we know all the global superposing results received by the station. Because those results might make a difference in the keys generated. So we have to know which results did the station receive. Can we establish that? The answer is, on principle, yes, because what is broadcast is public, so there's no requirement concerning confidentiality or secrecy. So we could publish that. How to publish that in a distributed system? Okay, if we go in the extreme situation, we do the same story as with the local outputs. We just ask each station for each round to sign the broadcast it got and publish that to everybody. Then, in case of an investigation, that station cannot change that, right? I'm not arguing that this is now pretty effective or efficient. And probably, as long as everything is fine, maybe we are not taking all those overheads. I'm now just going to the extreme case that we want to investigate and that we want to be prepared for an investigation. Okay, so the second kind of data, the global superposing results, can be, because they may be public, secured by digital signatures as well. So far I think we can do it, and maybe we should do it, whether there will be an investigation or not. Whether we do this until here is mainly a question, do we afford the expenses? It's not a question of sender or recipient anonymity. It doesn't deal with secret data. Okay? So until here, we would assume if we are well prepared, if we do all the digital signatures, it can be decided what happened. So, if we now want to understand which station did send a message, in the sense of it doesn't send the neutral element within the group, but some different element, that means it really did send a message. What do we have to know? All the keys of that station. Why? Because the output of the station is the sum of all the keys plus the message. So, if we can establish what was the output, we just discussed, we can. If, in addition, we can establish what are the key values, then we can calculate what was the message this station did send. In case of the DC Plus network, we even need more. It's not enough to know all the keys, but in addition, we have to know all the superposing results, because they are needed for the calculation of the particular key values. But we already discussed how to establish the superposing results. So how to establish the key values? One way to do it is ask, with whom did you share a key? And please, what has been the particular value of the key shared for the particular route? First part of the question, with whom did you share a key? How do we establish who shares keys with whom? We said the key graph, who shares keys with whom, is public or can be public. If we now want to investigate, we should not only say it can be public, we should say it should be public. It has to be public. Only then do we know how many keys that station had to add. Right? So again, we would argue that whenever you exchange a key with someone, you sign a message that you are exchanging a key with that entity. And maybe this message is published. This signed message is published. Okay, now we know with which stations that, with which other stations, the station we are just looking at, did exchange keys. Now we have to make sure we know the value of the keys. Not the whole key, but the value of the key for the relevant part of the key, right? So what do we do? Probably the first idea is asking the other station, knowing the key, what was the value? And of course asking the station as well, what was the value? If both stations agree, if the values they tell us are consistent, we would say, yes, we take it. If they are inconsistent, what do we know? One of the two, at least one of the two stations, is misbehaving. So we may well delete that key, because those two stations won't trust each other. One is misbehaving, so let's delete the key. If in our flow of investigation we come across a situation that we have to delete a key, then we delete it and just proceed. Not proceed with the investigation, but just restart the DC network and proceed. So in some sense, we agree that we are doing the investigation only until we find the first thing to do. First thing to do, maybe excluding a station, or maybe deleting a key. By the way, what do we do if we neither find a station to exclude nor a key to be deleted? That is, everything is fine. What should we do then? Then we should exclude the station requiring the investigation. Because what are we talking about? We are talking about preventing denial of service attacks by some kind of investigation. So this means if I start an investigation and it doesn't reveal a kind of attack, then starting the investigation is the kind of denial of service attack. So you should exclude that entity. So if you continue with this, and if you assume we have an attacker who wants to work against availability, what will happen? Okay, mainly there are two cases. One case is that our attacker is very, very stupid. Then probably quite early in the process, our attacker will do statements which are just self-contradictory. So, or he will admit that he did misbehave. So quite early in the game, we are going to exclude the attacker. If so, fine. Because if all stations being part in the DC network are honest, then we've got what we aimed at. If our attacker is more clever, which we should assume, because usually you shouldn't consider your enemies as being stupid, the attacker, which is jamming the network, that is, he's sending some messages, sending some non-neutral elements within the abelian group, when he or she shouldn't, the attacker will use keys exchanged with others to lie about whether he did send a neutral element or not. Because if he's changing the key value, he can argue, I did send the neutral element because I had this key value, right? But another entity, the entity he shared the key with, will say, no, you had, or we agreed to a different key value. And then we exclude a key, right? If we do so, and if we start with a limited number of keys, after a limited number of investigations, our attacker won't share any key with any honest station. Which now means, for him, end of the game. Why? Because it's pretty clear, if you have a station, or maybe the attacker even has a set of stations, which don't share keys with others, then in effect you have not one DC network, but at least two of them. So if you are up for sender anonymity and recipient anonymity, it just doesn't make sense to add all this stuff up. It's more efficient to say, hey, we take those stations which share keys and add it up, and the other stations which maybe have a different key graph, which is not connected to the first key graph, we take that separately. So we have two DC networks, which means the honest stations have excluded the attacking stations. And the attacking stations have their own DC network, where they may attack as long as they wish. Maybe nobody complains, because they are well organized. So they have lots of fun attacking each other all the day and enjoy that. I would say this is okay. If you enjoy that, do it. Maybe we may argue about electricity and energy consumption, and now get into a very green discussion. But if we exclude that for the moment, okay, they may do what they like. Of course, I should mention, just to give you a complete picture, things which haven't an effect, but I nevertheless should mention them. Of course, an attacker who has many stations could lie about key values within his stations. So he can, by transitivity, shift the conflict somewhere else. But sooner or later, either he will have a conflict with a honest station, or he will have a conflict within his stations. And in this case, he will lose a key as well. So the statement, the invariant, is whenever you jam, at the very least, you are losing a key. And if you are starting with a fixed set of keys, with a limited set of keys, losing a key whenever you attack means, in the long run, you haven't any keys. At least you haven't any keys which are valuable. Okay. So, maybe I should just comment that part of the slide, which I more or less explained implicitly. It's pretty clear if you have the keys, the output of the stations, and superposed results, then you can calculate the message, whether it's a neutral element or not. If you know something about the access protocol, and in a DC network, everybody should know which access protocol we are using, what are the rules of the access protocol, then by comparing the calculated message character and following the protocol, knowing who is entitled to do what and when, you can see whether the station followed the access protocol. So this was a lengthy repeat about how to trace attackers. Is it now clear? Is it clear to everybody else? Please, if not, ask. We have time. And I think we all feel better if what I talk is really understood, then just let me talk and say, okay, let's ignore what he's saying. It's hard to understand anyway. This is not a good procedure at the university.
Yeah, I do have some questions. First, in the reservation phase, why do we need two N slots? One reason I might have come up is, so if you could say, if I don't have anything to send, I use my slot as a trap. And so I will have traps and I will have messages and everything runs with one N. And the only downside may be that if I reveal a trap, I'm clearly not one of the ones sent an actual message. Is this the only reason or is there something else?
This is one of the reasons. And in addition, there's an additional reason. When I explained this frame, I argued, until here, no personal information made it into the protocol. Because I argued, if I have two N slots, that is, each of the N participants, does one reservation for a trap and a second reservation for a non-trap. So everybody does the same. Absolutely static. So until here, no personal information, which means until here, whenever someone says, hey, we have a kind of attack, he can investigate everything. Everything means everything from here to there, because there's no personal information. If I would say I'm reducing it by a factor of two, that is, I have only N reservations, and everybody decides whether to lay a trap or not, we have some kind of potentially personal information which makes it into that part, because if I'm laying a trap, it means I have nothing to send. If I'm not laying a trap, this probably means I have something to send. And this gives me at least some information about the state of the station. Maybe it's not much, but I couldn't argue that it's none. And in the description of the protocol until here, in the original publication, we argued, until here, we can trace everything without revealing any personal information. So this kind of invariant, this kind of statement, wouldn't be true. Of course, I see the value in what you say. In the static fashion, it's pretty clear. I have to waste half of my resources just for the traps. And on the internet, everybody has in his mind best effort delivery, best effort performance. Be dynamic. Don't be static. Try to use it as good as you can, which of course means any static allocation of resources is something which computer scientists consider as a kind of sin. The price you pay if you go for more dynamics, this kind of behavior tells me something about your demands, your wishes, your cues. And I, in designing this protocol with my colleagues together, I took a very fundamentalistic point of view. Now, as a computer scientist, you would argue, hey, okay. How do we do that? Can we do better than this? And then I would say, yes, I would do it slightly different. But to admit it, I wouldn't do it in your way. I would say, hey, when I have a DC network, maybe 100 people start to form a DC network. It's unclear whether within the 100 people we have an attacker. So probably signing all the stuff, laying traps, in many cases, it just would be overkill, right? So I would first start with a very optimistic protocol. Optimistic with respect to availability. I just omit all the traps. I would just maybe even omit all the digital signatures for making clear and committing to what was the output, what was the character received, etc. So get rid of everything you don't need absolutely. If it works, fine. If it doesn't work, then we know we have a kind of attacker. And then I would argue, and now we have to pay all the expenses I just described. I would allocate the resources in a static fashion, and that way force the attacker either in the long run to commit suicide or to follow the protocol. But I would start with an optimistic assumption: if there's no attack, then let's go for efficiency. And I would hope that since the attacker knows that if he does disturb the more efficient variant, what can he achieve? He can achieve that if he participates, he brings down the efficiency by a factor of 2. But he has to participate to stay there. Doesn't sound like a splendid good deal. He cannot bring it to 0. He cannot really block it. So my hope would be that because we have a fallback strategy where we can, let's say, prevent attackers from modifying attacks, I would hope we never ever will see anything in reality, because attackers know if the user base, the user community gets fundamentalistic about it, then they won't have a chance in the long run. What I wouldn't do, and this is now a kind of maybe even religious statement about engineering, I wouldn't do the compromise deeply implemented into your system. So I would like to have a system which has several states. One is maybe an optimistic state. We have no security against this and that, but we know exactly what we have. And if you want to prevent kinds of attacks, then I would like to have a clear strategy. If I'm going to open up everything here, what does this mean? So in some sense, I would argue that my system design is, if I may be optimistic, of the same efficiency as yours, and if you are a victim of massive attacks, then for some time my approach will be less efficient than yours, but after some time I have an opportunity to switch back to the more efficient way, and I have the clearer statement what kind of personal information may have made it to the attacker in the meantime. So this would be my kind of argument. I admit my way of viewing the world is not mainstream. I'm in some sense a security and privacy guy. And I'm very happy with best effort, bandwidth, best effort, timing. But if it comes to privacy, I'm slightly skeptical, and I'm arguing that best effort privacy or best effort security probably is not what we really need. And here I get a little bit religious. And for historical reasons, I would argue, whenever people built systems with a kind of best effort security, it was a nightmare. At least this is my perception. Of course, I would call, for example, the automatic teller machines of our banks a nightmare. And the banks would say, hey, it's a marvelous thing. We make a lot of money off it. And most people would say, hey, it's a nice thing. I get money whenever I like it, 24 hours, 7 days a week. And then I would say, hey, okay, you have been lucky. Nobody stand in your back and looked on your PIN input. Nobody managed to get your magnetic stripe card. You could be in a quite diverse situation. So I would argue a system which is a horrible system for 1 promille of the population probably isn't a really good system. But okay, again, this is a kind of religious statement. On average, you could argue it's nice. But on average, it's a very delicate argument. So just to tell a joke, let's assume you are shooting on some enemy. First you shoot at the left side, then you shoot on the right side. And then you argue on average he's dead. It's ridiculous. Average in many situations is not what we are aiming at. Okay, so I hope the design principles are clear, what I made. It's pretty clear that what I made somehow is expensive. Yes. And if you say, okay, it's expensive and I've understood it, then I would say, yes, you have got the point. That's reality. Okay. Further questions?
Next question. The details of this leg trap thing. What message does the station has to send? What contains this message? And how does it has to encrypt or sign or whatever the message to get this property that no one can see it is a trap, and after the station reveals it, everyone can check it? How does this exactly work?
I have the feeling you are asking me two questions. I try to answer them one after the other. The first question is, let's assume we are running this kind of protocol. How can a station trigger some kind of investigation? And the answer is, there are two, let's say, commonly agreed points in time where everybody could ask for an investigation. One point is here. After the reservation phase, everybody could ask. And if someone asks, it has to be done. If it doesn't reveal any violation of the protocol, then the entity asking for it is the attacker, right? Here's the second point. Everybody can ask for it. But to get it done, the person asking for it, and asking for it now doesn't mean investigation of everything, but here it means investigation of a particular slot. Here it meant investigation of everything. Here it meant or it means investigation of a particular slot. And let's assume I am here one of the participants. I argue I want to have, for example, slot 2 to be investigated. Then it's pretty clear, everybody knows, the value of the reservation of slot 2. Here, this is a kind of bit string. Let's assume it's 1,000 bits. Just some value we did for reservation. And now I have to open this blob, this bit commitment, as a bit commitment which tells, hey, this is a trap. Because only then, here, this part will be investigated. And now the simplest way to describe a bit commitment in a cryptographical setting was a bit commitment is just the encryption of 0 or 1 in a probabilistic asymmetric encryption system. Why probabilistic? Because otherwise you could just try out the plain text, 0 and 1. If it's probabilistic, it takes too much computational effort to break it, hopefully. How do you open such a blob, such a commitment? You just say, and this is a random number. How to check? You take the public key, the random number. Maybe you even tell them this was a trap, so the value 0 or 1 is known, which one. Then you encrypt it, meaning everybody does this, everybody encrypts that, and checks whether the outcome is the value here. If so, yes, this commitment has been opened successfully. Everybody has proof what the value is. And then if the value is this is a trap, we are going to open it here. We are going to investigate it here, right? If here I make a lot of fuss, I want slot 2 to be investigated, but then I can't give you information to open the commitment accordingly, then again, I'm an attacker. I'm just a person trying to stop or delay the procedure of the DC network. So you throw me out. Okay?
What sense does it make to ask after the reservation blocks for investigation?
So your question is, what sense does it make to do investigation here? So what would you propose? You would say no need ever to investigate it, or?
Yeah.
Okay, but maybe I shouldn't ask you how you would do it. I should argue, or should be able to argue, why I do it this way and why this is okay. An attacker, of course, could try to disturb the reservation phase. Just make sure it doesn't work out. I give you an example. I gave you this protocol, which was a quite efficient multi-access protocol. And if it works this way, it has a nice property that it brings those messages into a sequence. And as we designed the protocol, The sequence is just that we start with the smallest message, 1, 2, 5, 7, 15, right? So this works fine. So if this is the original set of messages sent and the protocol proceeds, then it delivers an ordered sequence of the messages, right? So this sounds like we can use it as a reservation scheme, this protocol as a reservation scheme, figuring out who is going to send when, right?
Okay, so if you use that as a reservation scheme, you could attack it by sending different messages each time.
Yes, so this is one attack, okay. But I would argue a more subtle attack is this. Your attack would mean that after I start it, then someone misbehaves here. And now if I would trace it, and tracing the whole thing, I would find out that a station did send a different message than it should have. So yes, if this kind of attack happens, we would find it out like you described it. Okay, maybe I should first make a pause here and say, yes, you are right. After the pause, I would say there's even a more subtle attack, which is harder to prevent, or which is, it's unclear whether it is to be prevented at all. Here, station 3 and 5 have the same message to send. The protocol here works out fine. It doesn't need more steps. All the messages are received. But this protocol will not enable us to determine whether then in the later sending phase, first S3 and then S5 should send, or vice versa. Because they are sending the same message, we don't get an ordering of those two messages because they are exactly the same, so you can't see this and that is that. And of course, if this happens by chance, what to do? Just repeat. Or an attacker, of course, could try not just let it happen by chance, because that longer bit strings are the same by chance. Okay, it's very, very improbable. An attacker could try to tap, oh, this was a bit string of one user. I'm going to take the same bit string. And so at least I'm very happy that until here I really can trace everything as often as I like without conveying any personal information. This was the argument about the religious attitude to security and privacy we just had. And what to do? It's unclear in the sense that I don't remember exactly what we did write in the original paper about it. But as far as I remember, I think there are two attitudes. One attitude is, if two of the reservations are exactly the same, so you don't know what to do, then trace it and make sure keys are lost between those stations. Same argument as with the inconsistency. One of the two is attacker. Delete the key. This could be one possibility. And probably this was a possibility we didn't do in the paper, if I remember it right. Second possibility is to say, hey, if two of these values or even more are the same, then of course we cannot guarantee collision freeness for those slots. Okay. Then those stations can't send. Okay. In some sense, this does not sound safe, because if an attacker could hinder some station from sending, maybe this is an avenue of attack, because he knows in this round one station can't send. I don't know. So what we did is, now let's see where I did write it down. I would argue that the kind of commitment we used once, we are using twice. So here, I argued, here, we have a commitment telling us whether it's a trap or not. And depending whether it's a trap or not, later on it is decided whether to investigate or not. And I could do the same trick once again at a lower level of the DC protocol. Usually in the DC network, maybe I go back. We said stations add up messages and keys, and then they send their message. I didn't argue whether this is first done by station one, and then by two, and then by three, whether it's done by all three at absolutely the same time. So, no way, or I didn't argue about that. By the way, it wouldn't be easy to enforce it. So, if I would be an attacker, what could I do? I would wait until two of the three have output, their sum, their local sum, and then I have an option to decide what my output as the attacker will be. And my output as the attacker determines then the global sum, right? So in such a scenario, the station sending last has some kind of advantage, because that station knows what the earlier stations did output. So if I want to disturb in some systematic way, I always would try to be slightly late and then determine my output. By the way, if you listen to discussions of human beings, a usual strategy is, first, let's make everybody his arguments, and then try to be the last one pointing out how arguments contradict each other. This usually gives you a good position, a more powerful position. And for me, it's absolutely funny why politicians try to be the first ones giving their arguments. in any political talk on TV. If you would have a strong moderator who enforces that everybody gets a fair share of time, then always I would try to be the last one talking. But okay. So, can we do something against that? And the answer is yes. And the basic idea is the commitment scheme. What was the commitment scheme? The commitment scheme was I could commit to a value. The value is now committed to, it's fixed. But nobody of you knows to which value I did commit. And you could do the same. You could commit to a value. The value is now fixed. I have no clue to which value you did commit to. Nobody has a clue, except you. And this means, if you go very fundamentalistic, and now it gets even more expensive, you would say, hey, stations don't output their local sum. What they output is a commitment for their local sum. And then they make sure they have all the commitments of the other stations. Now all the values are fixed. And now we are opening the commitments, one by one. Now the sequence, how commitments are opened, doesn't care. We don't care. Because everything is fixed before the first commitment is opened. And now we are going to open all the commitments before doing anything else. And this means, with this procedure, we can prevent that the person deciding late about its value has some kind of advantage. Which means if now here values are the same, then it must be between stations which did attack, which did coordinate to have the same value. Otherwise, it's really improbable, which gives us different strategies to punish. At this point here, the same values. So if it happens too often, just kick out those stations from the network. So what is the message to be learned? Until here. The message is, first, sender anonymity and the possibility to jam the network in the DC network are closely related. It's kind of dual to each other. If you can send anonymously in an additive network, you can jam it anonymously. First statement. Second statement, if we take some expense and it's complicated protocols, it's really expensive, we can make sure that in the long run, jamming the network will be punished, which hopefully discourages jamming the network. Third, the protocols we have are now, I would say, somehow tricky. There surely are different versions. And I wouldn't argue, hey, there's one best protocol to achieve it. We had several versions. Depending on how strong you feel your attacker is, the more expensive your protocol gets. I can't say this is better than that, because this is more expensive. Maybe it's more secure, but it's more expensive. Do we really need the expense? Therefore, I would assume that we only stop the expensive protocols if you really need them. So let's start with an optimistic variant first. By the way, in my group, we are during those weeks just implementing the DC Plus network for large-scale deployment. So we want to do experiments with larger groups of people, whether this works that way. And positioning that as an extension of the Anon system. Because within the DC network, by the way, there's no useful possibility to do data retention. Because what data should you retain? Or the local outputs? I would say that's ridiculous. What else could you retain? The message here, but according to German law, this is not okay because it would force you to say something against yourself. The keys, if you retain them and the output is known, the key values tell whether you did send something. Again, you would have to say something against yourself, which is nothing you can enforce in Germany. So in some sense, we are just doing this kind of implementation because we strongly feel that this is a system which is secure against, at least in Germany, any laws with respect to data retention. But let's see. Maybe I'm not a lawyer, but as far as I see, I would argue that way. And if we do that kind of experiment, of course, we will learn how complicated protocols we really need. Of course, in our implementation, we start with the simple ones. But I push that even the complicated ones we are going to implement, just to have them in case we need them. So I think we are pretty close to the end of the DC network slides. Until here, I really talked about attacks. Hopefully we won't have attacks, then we can start with simpler protocols. But we have a kind of security which can stand really clever modifying attacks. Of course, in real life, if things go wrong, it's not always an attack. Often things go wrong because of some kind of misunderstanding, if it's between human beings, or because just some computers or electronic devices had some kind of fault or failure. So what to do? If it's about errors, and if it's not about attacks. Because handling errors could be much more efficient than handling attacks. Why? Errors are somehow stupid. You can make maybe some assumptions about errors. Okay, one way to do it is now handling errors, that is talking about fault tolerance, that we have two modes of operation. An anonymity mode and a fault tolerant mode. I call it A mode and F mode. So in A mode, we just do anonymous transmission of messages using superposed sending. if something goes wrong, if a fault is detected, then we switch from A mode to F mode. In F mode, no sending of sensitive information. We do some kind of fault localization, that is, which computer did break down. We will take defective components out of operation. We will then go back to A mode by reinitializing the pseudo-random generators and reinitializing the access protocol. And then we can just continue. That is, if you are talking about errors, we can just switch between the two modes. Of course, this would never ever help against modifying attacks, because everybody knows in which mode we are. So an attacker would not misbehave here. So you couldn't do a diagnosis which station was wrong, and an attacker would only disturb here in A mode. So one way to do fault tolerance. A second way to do fault tolerance is to say, let's assume we have many, many, many DC networks. And if you look at this, we have a particular kind of interconnection structure such that those dots mean we have write and read access to the DC network. And without a dot, it means we have just read access to the DC network. So what do we have here? We have a DC network 1, where stations 1, 2, 3, and 4 have write access, but all others have read access. So what is DC network 1? It's a network which has less sender anonymity than a DC network comprising all the stations 1, 2, through 10 would have. Because here in this DC network, it's only 4 stations which can send. So sender anonymity is decreased. In network 2, it's station 1, 5, 6, 7. Again, it's 4 stations which can send, and so on. And now, if you look what might happen, let's assume station 3 misbehaves. It runs havoc. It just doing a denial of service attack against all the networks that station is connected to, including write access. That is, station 3 can bring down network 1, and it can bring down network 4, right? Is this a problem? I would argue until here it's not a problem, because all other stations still have a DC network they can use for sending. Station 1 can send on DC network 2. Station 2 can send on DC network 3. Of course, station 3 can't send because it's just bringing down all the networks it's connected to. Station 4 can send on network 5. Station 5 can send on both networks, fine. Station 6 can send on network 2. Station 7 on networks 2 and 5. 8 on the network 3. 9 on the networks 3 and 5. And station 10 can send on network 5. So this is a kind of error correcting or error tolerating coding done with respect to who or which station can send on which DC network. And this code is tolerating one station. one station running Havoc. If you take a second station running Havoc, then there will be stations which are okay, but which can't send anymore. So I did choose here stations 3 and 5 such that here it's 1 and 4, and here it's 2 and 3. So two stations can bring down four networks. So it's only DC network 5, which is still functioning. Which means, of course, that station 1 can't send, station 2 can't send, 4 can, 6 can't, 7 can, 8 can't, 9 can, 10 can. So this would be a configuration, stations 3 and 5 running Havoc, which would hinder some other stations from sending. And I think this is everything I wanted to say about the DC network. So do you have questions? So just keep in mind those last slides. It's only about errors. It's not about clever attacks. Of course, you could argue if the interconnection here is given that way, okay, it's even preventing against an attack of station 3. But surely this kind of code wouldn't protect against a coordinated attack of 3 and 5. The situations we had until now are, if we want to have sender anonymity, it's really expensive. Why? In the ring network, providing a kind of ring, a physical structure, is expensive, and it has a property that if you have a ring of, let's say, 1,000 stations, and you have some fixed bandwidth within the ring, then it's pretty clear, on average, each station can only send one in 1,000 parts of the bandwidth, right? Because 1,000 stations share the bandwidth of the ring. So each gets only a fraction, one part within 1,000 parts, 1 promille. Same argument with the superposed sending. Maybe I should go back to that slide. If station 1 wants to send a message, as is depicted here, all other stations have to send a message as well. In here, they have to send the neutral element. And again, all the stations share the bandwidth of the network. In this example, if you have 3 stations, each one can only, on average, use 1/3 of the bandwidth. If it would be 1,000,000 station, this would mean each station only could use 1 of 1,000,000 messages for sending, right? Which means the larger the network gets, the smaller the fraction each station may use for sending. Doesn't sound well. Because usually if we build networks which scale, it's a very bad idea if our network gets bigger, that what we might use within the network gets smaller. I'm pretty sure nobody would enjoy that. But this, of course, is a consequence if all senders share the same fixed channel as in the ring network, at the physical layer, or here in the DC network, at the logical layer, some layer where we say we have this kind of additive channel. So, until now, no anonymity systems which are deployed at a large scale use any of those techniques. And if you are starting to implement the DC network, the DC plus network in particular, for gaining some resistance to data retention, then we don't aim, I wouldn't hope that we will be able to run networks of millions of users within a particular DC network. I would be very happy if the outcome is it can be, let's say, 1,000 users. Even 100 users, I would say, is a good result. Now let's start with the mixes. And the mixes are a technique which scales much better, which is one of the reasons why mixes are implemented on a large scale. They are usable for sending email, for browsing the web. They are usable for different purposes. They are first invented in 1981 by David Chaum. And David Chaum invented them for electronic mail. So first I will describe everything in a kind of framework for sending messages. And later on I will discuss whether mixes can as well be used for switching channels. So what's the idea? The idea is we have dedicated network stations called mixes, which receive messages, batch them, they store them. For cryptographical reasons, they will discard repeats, and then they forward the messages to maybe a next mix, mix two here. And this mix, again, batches, that is, the mix awaits enough messages, again, discards repeats, and again, changes somehow the appearance of messages, and outputs them again. So if you look globally, and in this drawing, we pretend we can look into the messages, which in reality we couldn't. So if you look into this message, you see, hey, this gets that, and this message then later on gets this. So this message makes it that way. If you only look at the outer appearance of the messages, you wouldn't have a clue whether this message here gets this, that, or that. And again, nobody would have a clue whether to this message, the input message was this, this, or this. What is clear is that this mix one knows which of his input messages correspond to his output messages. And it's pretty clear that mix two knows which of his input messages corresponds to his output messages. But as long as mix one and two don't cooperate, nobody knows which of the original inputs corresponds to the final outputs. It's pretty clear if mix one and two cooperate, if they pool their information, if they share their information, then they can determine this message was transformed to that message. This is something mix one knows. And this message then is transformed to that message. This is something mix two knows. So if they pool their information, they can trace the message from here over there to there. But assume we are not using two mixes, but 10 or maybe even hundreds of them. Let's assume those mixes are in different countries, are operated by different operators, where we choose the operators such that to minimize the probability that they cooperate in a secret fashion against their users, then it gets really very unlikely that all the mixes cooperate to trace users. So maybe one of the mixes is operated by the German Ministry of the Interior. The next mix is operated by the Italian Mafia. So I would usually assume that the German Ministry of the Interior and the Mafia don't cooperate. You never can be sure, but I would say it's relatively unlikely. And then let's assume we take one mix operated by the Roman Catholic Church. Okay, now it's cooperation with the Mafia. Okay, now it gets difficult. As some people might see it, other people would say, no, never ever. The Roman Catholic Church would cooperate with anybody. But, okay. So you see, if we take very different operators of mixes, it gets unlikely that they cooperate against their users. Of course, if the German Ministry of the Interior run Microsoft software operating system, if the Mafia runs Microsoft software, maybe the same, and if the Roman Catholic Church runs Microsoft software, then the interesting question is, hey, would Bill Gates be in a position to trace the messages? And if Bill Gates would be able to trace the messages, would then the American government be able to trace the messages? Because maybe they have a particular relationship to Microsoft. The answer is, we don't know. Of course, if you ask Microsoft, they will tell you, we never ever will particularly cooperate with the American government. But probably it's pretty clear that even if they would cooperate with the American government completely, of course in public they would have to say, we never do. So it's not really useful information you get by asking Microsoft. And of course the same story would be true if I would replace Microsoft by Apple. the only thing which makes Microsoft special is that Microsoft on the private laptops and desktop machines is the market leader and Apple isn't. How to argue about Linux? You might argue Linux is open source, everybody could inspect all the code. So I hope whenever you boot your machine, you inspect the code. Okay, history tells us that even within Linux, it has lasted for years before severe flaws have been detected. So if within a project like Linux, you would have programmers with good reputation which would intend to build in a Trojan horse, I would argue probably it's doable. And it will take months, if not years, before it will be detected. So what to do? Make sure this mix runs maybe Linux. This runs macOS, and the third one runs System 7 or something like that from Microsoft, right? Then hopefully, Linux, Apple, and Microsoft don't use common software engineering tools. If they use a common compiler, I explained to you what a transitive Trojan horse is, you could have a problem. So what you see, mixes really should be independent. By the way, is this really new? I would argue not really. Because, for example, if you implement the DC network and all the participating user stations run Windows, they all share the same Trojan horse, then it's pretty clear what maybe the US government could do. So usually when we are talking now about anonymous communication, we assume that not all the operating systems are working against the user base. If they do, zero chance. Okay, so let's assume that. How do we do it cryptographically? Here in this picture, I just gave you the feeling that messages are somehow put into boxes of different forms. And indeed, you could do so. For example, if you would like to order physical goods from Amazon, you could ask Amazon to ship your goods using, for example, DHL, to some place of another delivery company, repackage the goods, and then send it to you. Of course, everybody would argue that, hey, if it's about energy consumption, this isn't a good idea. With respect to privacy, it might be a good idea. And this is mainly the same we do with mixes. Messages are not sent the direct way, but they are routed through additional stations called mixes and change their appearance there. And of course, it's not repackaging them physically, but do it cryptographically. And this is how it might be done. Mix 1 chooses a key pair, a decryption key D1 and a ciphering key C1. And the main equation we know is if you first encrypt using C1, later on decrypt using D1, then it cancels. And what we encrypt here is a random number Z, Zufallszahl in German, and the message M. And of course, if you first encrypt and then decrypt, you get it again. What is output from the mix is the message only, not the random number Z. Why? Because if you would output Z as well, if you would output all you get by decryption, then you could just take the output, each single output, use the public key of the mix, and encrypt it. And then you would get one of the inputs. Therefore, it's essential that at least some part of the message is never output by the mix, just to prevent that someone takes the output units and encrypts them again and compares with the input units. The same happens here with mix 2. It has a key to cipher, a key to decipher, and again we have probabilistic encryption by means of this random number Z, and it's only the message which is output. So in this simple scheme, how are messages be prepared for processing? You take the message which shall make it to the final recipient. You encrypt it probabilistically with the public key of the last mix. And then the result you encrypt again probabilistically with the public key of the mix before. And in this case of two mixes, this is the end of the story. And then on its way through the mixes, this message, first in mix one, is decrypted, being the inverse to the last encryption here, and it gets this message. And then it's decrypted with the inverse of the first ciphering key, and then it gets this message. Okay? In this scheme, which is the basis of the electronic mail system David Schaub described, for each message, you need an asymmetric cryptographic operation. This is not really a problem if we are talking about email. An email may well take a few minutes to reach its final destination, and some people would argue it may well take a few hours until it's reaching its final destination. By the way, many of you, including me, in the meantime, are using email mainly as instant messaging. So we assume that an email I send is with my partner a few seconds later. But this is not the original definition of service for email. Email means arrives within a day or two. Or let's be a little bit more optimistic, arrives within an hour or two. If we would talk about browsing the web or if you would talk about telephony, getting the message with a delay of an hour or two probably wouldn't be much fun. If you ask for a web page, and after an hour or two you get it, then probably you are using GPRS, and you have a web page which is heavily loaded with high-resolution computer graphics you never need on your screen. So this is the feeling you get. And when I first experienced that in my life, I really got upset. So we need a better strategy for those applications. Or if you're talking about telephony, what is an acceptable delay? Usually telephony means two people interact, right? How much delay can you stand? Anything larger than half a second or so means that both will interrupt each other from time to time. They will appear to be very unpolite because they will interrupt very brutally. But all what happened is you have the delay. So both start talking, and only after half a second they notice, oh, shit, we started roughly at the same time. Let's do it again. So you have a common feeling what is a good pause, so maybe you wait a second, just to be polite, and then you start again. And your partner, who has roughly the same feeling about timing, will do the same. So, shit, second collision. So, okay. And now you either would need a kind of protocol for telephony where you would say over explicitly, or you need a channel with a much smaller delay. So what could we do for mixes? We could try to use the scheme I just described, which works fine for electronic mail, for channel setup, for exchanging keys, maybe of a symmetric system. And then we use the symmetric cryptographic system for the real communication. This means a mix does not incur delay for an asymmetric encryption system, but it only incurs delay for a symmetric one. And for a symmetric one may mean, if you are talking about the one-time pad or the pseudo one-time pad, a mix only incurs delay of 1 bit. And now it gets much more practical. So this is the idea that we take the asymmetrically encrypted and decrypted messages for connection setup, or in the limiting case for channel setup, and then have much shorter delay within the connection or within the channel to enable services we couldn't enable if we just would stick to message passing, or more precisely the passing of messages which are unrelated. Doing a little bit more privacy discussion, if you have these messages, and if you look here and here, all these messages look pretty unrelated. If in the next time frame, again, the public keys of the mixes are used, the messages of the next time frame look completely unrelated. The mixes have no need to know whether messages are related, because they just take their secret key. They just have one secret key and they decrypt it. That's it. No need for mixes to know any relationship between messages. This is surely different if you are talking about connection setup or channel switching. Because if this line here means everything coming in here is decrypted with a symmetric key, with a particular symmetric key, which is a different key than this key which is used to decrypt here, which is a different key than this key which decrypts here, then surely if you did establish connections which each have a different symmetric key, mixes have to know if you have incoming bit streams or incoming packets, to which connection, to which symmetric key do these packets, streams, whatever you have, belong. So here, everything is simple. Each packet, each message is processed completely independently from anything else at the cryptographic level. Here, some relationships are established. All messages which are transmitted within one connection belong together. And mixes have to know that they belong together because they have to use the same symmetric key, which is linking all those messages. Linking those messages, of course, isn't a problem if those messages are linked anyway. But for some services, it may be some kind of additional linking, and then we should do some evaluation whether it's worth it or not. Okay, so far, the high-level principles. So what are basic functions of a mix? First, a mix gets input messages. Okay. Next, the mix is going to discard repeats. How to do that? To do that, the mix needs somehow a database of all input messages which were or will be re-encrypted using the same key. So if you want to discard repeats, you have to remember what came in before. Why do we have to discard repeats? If I put in the same bit string here twice, I will get out the same bit string twice. Because decryption is deterministic. Even if encryption is probabilistic, and in this sense is indeterministic, decryption is deterministic. And therefore, if you wouldn't discard repeats, it would mean same input, same output. How could you use that to attack mixes? Okay, if you are interested in some message, you just make sure it's input twice. And then you look which bit pattern will repeat twice at the output. Now you know what the mix made out of the message you are interested in. And if this doesn't give a unique result, then you put it in three times or four times or at certain different time intervals. Okay. So, because decryption is deterministic, we have to discard repeats as long as the key for decryption is the same, which, by the way, then means that mixes mainly are not crypto devices, but that mixes mainly are huge database systems because they have to store lots of messages. Then a mix has to buffer the current input batch. It has just to buffer all the messages which are not repeats for some time, just to make sure enough messages made it to the mix. If possible, the mix should check whether there are sufficiently many messages from sufficiently many senders. Of course, if you're talking about anonymity, if all those messages all come from the same sender, it doesn't generate anonymity. So it's not only that you have enough messages, you should have enough messages from many different senders. By the way, this is of course something which is not really easy to enforce. Because how do you make sure on the internet that two messages are not from the same sender? If we would have a public key infrastructure, the German government is just trying to get it using the next generation of passports. If we would have a public key infrastructure, we could say everybody is going to sign all the messages. And everybody has only one public key in his passport. Then you could use that to make sure that two messages originated with different senders. As long as you haven't a PKI, how should you use? How should you know that it's from different senders? So hopefully we have sufficiently many messages from sufficiently many senders. What do we do if we haven't enough messages? Two strategies. Wait until more messages arrive. Or insert dummy traffic. Generate messages. Generate dummy traffic. Then re-encrypt the messages. And in the examples we just had, it mainly meant decrypt messages. For some other schemes, we'll come across them, it might mean encrypt messages. But here, for the simple examples we just had, it means decrypt messages. Then, finally, the mix should change the order of the message. So no first in, first out. Otherwise, it wouldn't be useless to do cryptographic stuff on the net, on the messages. And then you output messages. This is what a mix does. And in one of the exercises, I'm asking you the question, is then the flow of operations uniquely determined, or could you start with other operations? And I think this kind of flow of events mainly is a canonical implementation. What does this mean with respect to delay in each mix? It means discard repeats means you do a lookup in your database. Usually this means at least one access to your hard drive, which roughly means 10 milliseconds. Okay, in older times, if you have a very slow hard drive, maybe it's 50 milliseconds. Sufficiently many messages from sufficiently many senders. In the fast variant, we are just going to ignore the problem. In the most expensive version, you are checking a digital signature, and maybe even you are checking the corresponding public key certificate. So I took twice the time of an asymmetric encryption, so 100 milliseconds for digital signatures. Then we encrypt or decrypt. If it's special hardware, maybe it's fast, maybe it's 1 millisecond. If it's software, again, 100 milliseconds. Some reordering, maybe it's very fast, some nanoseconds or a few microseconds. And if you add it up, and if I did that correctly, it mainly means in the fast variant, you end up with a time which is given by your hard drive. And if we are using costly asymmetric operations, then it's mainly given by the time needed for doing the encryption, decryption, testing of signatures. So you see, if it's 11 milliseconds, we could afford a few mixes and still do telephony. If it's a quarter of a second, then having, let's say, 2 or 3 mixes is not a good idea, at least for a normal conversation. What properties of mixes we would like to have? Mixes should be designed independently. So no common design problems. They should be produced independently. The code should be distributed accordingly. They should be operated independently. So one by the German Ministry of the Interior, one by the Mafia, and one by the Roman Catholic Church, in the example I used in the beginning. And of course, they should be maintained independently. So one by the German Ministry of the Interior. I'm not sure whether they have much experience in software maintenance. One by the Mafia. Probably they know better what they do. And one by the Roman Catholic Church. And again, I'm a little bit in doubt whether they have real experience in software maintenance. Okay. What might be a very bad idea if all the three of them hire a consultant? Because maybe the same consultant to all of them. If I would be the National Security Agency, I would offer consultancy services to all MIGS operators worldwide. Right? You see the motivation? Messages passing through MIGSes should be of the same length. Because if they are of different length, then it's easy to trace messages by their length. And those messages of the same length should be buffered, re-encrypted, and the order should be changed in a batch-wise fashion. That is, you take several messages together, maybe a few or some hundreds or maybe even some tens of thousands. You buffer them, you re-encrypt them, and you change the order. Each message should be processed only once. And this has to be true first inside each batch, but, and this makes it more difficult, it also should be true between the different batches. It has to be enforced as long as you are using the same key. Okay, if you want to get rid of the database, what do you do? After each batch, you're changing your key, right? Then you don't need a database to check between different batches whether message already has been processed. But key exchange also incurs some expenses. And if you want to have something like a return address, that is an address which can be used, which surely then has to do something with the keys of the MIGSes. So the return address is only valid as long as the keys of the MIGSes stay the same. So if you are now changing the keys after each batch, then it makes return addresses really a problem. So it's not really a very easy solution what to do to ensure that each message is only processed once. Next, can we use symmetric encryption? In the picture I showed to you, I only had asymmetric encryption. And in the general case for MIGSes, you really need asymmetric encryption, at least to start with. Maybe you use asymmetric encryption to bootstrap symmetric encryption. That is mainly you do something which we called hybrid encryption last year, right? So the question here is, can we use symmetric encryption from the very start? And the answer is, for some of the MIGSes, yes, but not for all of them. We may do so for the first MIG, because usually in our attacker model, okay, I should talk a little bit about attacker models. Usually we assume that, like in the DC network, in the MIG network, all lines are tapped. That is, everybody knows which messages make it to the first MIG. Even the MIG may know from where those messages come. Because maybe the MIG is using an IP protocol, so each of those messages has an IP sender's address. Again, those messages are transmitted. Let's assume all those messages are tapped. And finally, those messages are transmitted. Let's assume all those messages are tapped. So the last MIG knows to which IP address, for example, he's sending. And now the first MIG And the last mix, and in this picture, regrettably, we have no middle mix. So the first mix knows where messages come from. So he knows the sender. So he could exchange with the sender a symmetric key, which then he might use. The last mix might know the recipient, so he might exchange with the recipient a symmetric key he might use to encrypt the message. But a middle mix, let's imagine we had one, a middle mix should neither know where the message originally came from, nor should he know where the message finally goes to. And therefore, a middle mix would have no information, or should have no information, which symmetric key to use. And therefore, middle mixes mainly need an asymmetric encryption system to bootstrap, if symmetric keys are to be used, to bootstrap it in the way hybrid encryption works. So, symmetric encryption exclusively can be used only with respect to the first and last mix. For the middle mixes, maybe you use hybrid encryption, but in any case, you have to use somehow asymmetric encryption. So what is our aim? What do we want to achieve? And first, I'm going to formulate it without any dummy traffic, because our aim is clearer if we keep the mix functionality pure and don't intermingle it with dummy traffic. So what we would like to have is that communication, the communication relationship, can only be revealed by either all other senders and recipients working together. So let's assume you two are communicating to each other, and we all others do communicate as well to each other. Now, except you two, we all agree that we want to trace who communicates to whom. So we take one message after each other and just figure out who did send it, who did receive it. And if we then come across messages where neither of us says, I'm the sender or I'm the receiver, and you are the only two guys who are left open and left over, then it's pretty clear you exchanged a message. So you know each other, you have some kind of communication relationships. So, and this of course is now a statement which is a very fundamental statement. If you have a set of users communicating and everybody's cooperating except two, then these two probably haven't any privacy. Can you improve that? Yes, by dummy traffic. Of course, if we introduce dummy traffic, that there's some message nobody of the rest is involved in, it could mean you have some kind of relationship or you're just sending dummy traffic to somewhere. But if you ignore dummy traffic, if all the rest works against two people, then they have not really privacy with respect whether they communicate yes or no. Okay. And the second possibility is how to trace people, that all mixes work together, and in particular, all mixes which the message passed. So please remember, even if you use mixes, there are ways to trace who is going to send to whom. Two possibilities, either all mixes. This is what is usually discussed. And this usually is done if you are talking about data retention with respect to mixes. If each mix has to retain data, which input message made it to which output message, what the relationship is, and to has to hand that information over to law enforcement, then it's pretty clear how to trace messages. Of course, the problem is if you keep that information and if you can pass it to law enforcement easily, then probably if someone shows up in your office and tells you, hey, this is a firearm, please could you tell me the information, then probably it would be relatively straightforward and easy to hand over that information to non-law enforcement agencies as well. Or if some computer which stored that information ever gets hacked, you might have the same problem. But keep in mind, even if the mixes never ever will work together to trace people, if enough other people work together, if enough of the users work together, it will have the same effect. We had in the DC network the discussion, if I get to see a message which is threatening someone, and we had a discussion over the break whether such a message should be traced and could be traced, because maybe not everybody agrees whether it's threatening or not. Here, pretty much the same. Even if the mixes don't cooperate, if all but two users cooperate, then mainly the game is over. Okay, let's assume these are the aims. Can we draw some conclusions about what might be possible, what might not be possible, and how an implementation would look like? One conclusion is a conclusion about the re-encryption business. And the conclusion is we will never have a decryption directly after an encryption. Why? For the decryption of the encryption, we would need the corresponding key. And then, before and after, the message would be the same. So this encryption, decryption would be pretty useless. So this is one rule we might keep in mind when designing re-encryption schemes. And the second conclusion is that if we want to have maximal protection, then all the mixes should be passed through simultaneously. And if we require that all the mixes are passed through simultaneously by all the messages, then it follows that they are passed through in the same order. Here in the two mixes in this example, probably you hadn't the feeling that I'm talking about routing. And in effect, if you take implementations of mixes, for example, Tor, you have an awful lot of flexibility which kind of routing to use. And many people have the feeling, hey, if each station does routing independently of all the other stations, this gives many more possibilities. And intuitively, many people believe more possibilities means more protection. But this conclusion tells us if we are aiming at a strong attacker, if you are aiming at an attacker who controls all mixes which are passed, but one, then we can conclude that all mixes should be passed through simultaneously. I will argue that in a minute. And since this is true, we can therefore argue that mixes have to be passed in the same order, which means that against strong attackers, free routing through mixes is a splendid, stupid idea, which is one of the disputes between my research group and the Tor group, where I say Tor is, I would say, ill-designed, because it gives flexibility in a situation where against strong attacker there should not be any flexibility. It should be used through the same mixes. But of course in a peer-to-peer network setting it's really hard to fix something. So we in the Anon project decided to have a fixed sequence of mixes in the so-called mix cascade. And of course it's not peer-to-peer, it's more server-based. Okay, so maybe I should next argue why is it important that mixes are passed through simultaneously, and this is done through this drawing. Let's assume mix I is the only mix which is a good one. All the other mixes are compromised by the attacker, which is the usual setting if we are talking about a strong attacker. A strong attacker might compromise all mixes but one. So mix I is a good one. Now let's assume that not all messages pass through mixes in the same order. So with respect to the good mix, we have some blue messages and some red messages. Assuming that the blue messages pass, for example, earlier, and the red messages pass later. So they don't pass at the same time. Then, because all the other messages are bad, we could, of course, trace back these input blue messages to the original senders. And, of course, the output blue messages we could trace to their final recipients. And then we would know these three senders communicate with these three recipients. The same we could do with respect to the red messages. We could take the red input messages of the good mix, we could go back, and we could take the output messages of the good mix, the red output messages of the good mix, and we could go forward. And then we could know, okay, from these three senders, the following three recipients get a message. And what is the information gain by that those three messages pass through the good mix at a different time interval than these three? the information gain is. In an optimal system, we would know, okay, there are six senders, and any of the six senders could send to any of the six recipients. And this gain here tells us there are three senders where we know they are sending to three recipients. And there are other three senders which send to other three recipients, which gives us more information about who is sending to whom. So in a setting where only this mix is a good one, this gives additional information, which means that if you want to have maximal protection against a strong attacker, all messages have to pass through all mixes in the same order. Until now, with mixes, I didn't mention sender anonymity and recipient anonymity. You remember? We had sender anonymity for the DC network. Recipient anonymity was provided by broadcast. In the ring network, we had recipient anonymity by the broadcast nature of the ring. We had sender anonymity by not being able to trace all the lines. Now we should discuss which use of encryption supports what kind of anonymity. And the basic scheme I started with is a sender anonymity scheme. That is, the sender is going to encrypt many, many times, according to the number of mixes, the message. Then it sends the message to the first mix. This mix decrypts, sends it further to the next mix. The next mix decrypts, sends it further to the next mix, decrypts, and so on and so forth. So I'm using here a graphical notation where downwards means encryption, horizontally means transfer, and upwards means decryption. So why is this a sender anonymity scheme? The recipient who finally gets the messages, or the message, even if it works together with some of the mixes, but not all of them, has no way to determine the original sender. Because for one of the mixes, he doesn't know which input of the mixes working with him corresponds to which output of the mixes cooperating with him. Why is this scheme not a recipient anonymity scheme? Because the sender, who does all the encryptions one by one, of course knows all the intermediate states of the message. So here, the sender knows the output of the last mix. Here, the sender knows the output of the mix before, and so on and so forth. That is, the sender, by keeping those intermediate values of the message, the sender could trace the message on its way to the recipient. And therefore, it's a sender anonymity scheme. The sender knows, but the recipient doesn't. I call this scheme a direct re-encryption scheme for send anonymity because the asymmetric keys are applied to the whole message. And an indirect scheme is a kind of hybrid encryption scheme where I'm using the public key of a mix to encrypt a symmetric key. And I do that, if I like, for all the mixes. So each mix first does a decryption with his secret asymmetric key. Then he gets a symmetric key, which is, in its use, much more efficient. And then the symmetric key is used for, in this case, decrypting the whole message. Then again, it's forwarded to the next mix. This next mix uses its secret decryption key to decrypt a symmetric key. The symmetric key is used to decrypt the whole message, which then is passed to the next mix, and so on and so forth. And here I did give you the coding scheme as a set of recursive equations. So this is sender anonymity in a direct way and in an indirect way. And now it's a quite natural question to ask, could we do recipient anonymity? And the answer is yes, we can. Here in recipient anonymity, we would require that the recipient does an encryption again and again and again and again. Then somehow this kind of return address is transferred. I call that an unobservable transfer, is transferred to the sender. And then the sender gets a symmetric key. So it's an indirect scheme as well. And this symmetric key is used to encrypt the answer, the message back. The next mix, by using its decryption key D1, gets another symmetric key, and this symmetric key is used to once more encrypt the message. So with a scheme for recipient anonymity, a message has now two parts. The leading part is decrypted, and the answer is encrypted. So finally, the recipient gets back some part which tells him, okay, this is a set of symmetric keys. And then he uses those set of symmetric keys to decrypt in the appropriate sequence of the keys the message back. So, and again, you might write that in a set of recursive equations. I call this the message header, and I call this the message content. And the sender, the recipient forms the header, just starting with a kind of value he will get back, and then he is going to encrypt it for this mix, 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 sends it, and then the sender will put it on its path through the mixes in this direction. And in addition, the sender will put the message content towards its way, and each mix will encrypt the message content. So in the end, the message header is completely decrypted when it returns, and the message content is maximally encrypted when it returns. So the recipient has to decrypt it in the appropriate fashion. So do you have questions?
How can you make the transfer unobservable in the initial transfer?
For example, I could use a sender anonymity scheme from here to there. Unobservable here means it should be unobservable from the sender and maybe the mixes. So the scheme from here to there could just be a sender anonymity scheme used by R to send something to S. Okay. Further questions? What is the next question? What is the next problem to be solved? Yes, sure. How do we do it? In some sense, we just put both schemes together. So if you look here, this seems to be mainly a sender anonymity scheme because we only have decryption, and we do it for the message content as well, decryption all the time. And this part is the recipient anonymity scheme, where we have decryption for the message header, and where we have encryption for the message body, for the message content. We have a kind of third party, which may be used to start the communication because, how do you start communication if you don't know to whom you want to communicate? And here you need some kind of third party which at least tells you something about your communication partner. Because if you have no clue to whom you want to communicate, then I would argue communication is nonsense. But if you have some kind of service, so maybe you have a third party who says, okay, maybe it's a kind of dating service. So you are looking for a nice woman or a nice boy or whatever you're looking for, I don't know. Maybe there's some service offer. Hey, I can give you a possibility to contact some women or boys which are interested in some kind of dating. In the beginning, you don't know who you are contacting. So first you communicate, and only if you have the feeling you are really interested in, then you tell the other person who you really are or how to really meet. So this is just one use. Maybe there are better uses than anonymous or pseudonymous online dating. So, what would we do? If you start here, you would query this service with a kind of sender anonymity scheme and then you get some information how to contact that person. You would pick up it here using some recipient anonymity scheme, and this could again be initiated using some kind of sender anonymity scheme, and then it would work. So going back, mainly it means both schemes are used. You have here some interfaces where you couple the communication, and for setup you need a third party, because otherwise you have no clue whom to contact and how. And this party gets some information by R, maybe by S. They want to participate. Then later on, R and S have to take up the information of the other party. And then it might start. OK, so see you next week.